Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Monday, July 14th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Austin O'Malley and Alan Cawley debate our weekend sporting highlights. Brendan Devaney joins the conversation to review the weekend's All-Ireland football semi-finals, while Stephen Higgins reflects on the Wimbledon finals. And Shane Stokes is standing by to discuss Ben Healy claiming the yellow jersey at the Tour de France. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, happy Monday, one and all. Welcome along to the show. It is great to have your company. We are already in the company of Austin O'Malley and Alan Cawley. Al, how are you?
I'm great, Shane. Yourself?
Very well, very, very well. Nice day of sport with Ben Healy, which we will get to very shortly. Great day of test cricket as well, so it was with England India. We'll get to that even a bit later. Austin O'Malley, how's the form?
Really good, have to say. Yeah. Really, really good this evening.
Fresh from a somewhat entertaining weekend of Gaelic football.
Yeah, fresh enough. Was in Croker yesterday, obviously, and there's a lot in it, I suppose. But I suppose the narrative coming out over the weekend was maybe that the games maybe didn't live up to the building. But I suppose we'll dissect those later. But still, all in all, there was a lot of good energy around Croker over the weekend.
Absolutely. We will debate our weekend sporting highlights. But big news in the last hour. Ben Healy is just the fourth Irish cyclist to wear the famous yellow jersey as he leads the Tour de France after 10 stages of this year's race. Shane Stokes of the Velo joins us on the line now to just reflect and digest this absolutely brilliant news for Irish cycling, Shane.
Yeah, it really is. And to put it in perspective, Stephen Roach was the last to wear the yellow jersey, and that's way back in 1987. So what's that, 38 years ago? So it's been quite a wait. And before then was Shea Elliott in 1963, Sean Kelly in 1983. And now Ben Healy is the fourth ever Irishman to lead the race, which is incredible, right?
Some great television coverage, and I do want to just play in this clip from TG Carr, which just has the joy, just the absolute joy of Ben Healy securing the yellow jersey.
Tommy the counter secondy. Big Ben Healy against the wheel up. Chapeau. Ben Healy looked like the Den Kedor on Lady Gotto Shacht, Gomeg on Gansy Bui or Hole Erenig. Chapeau, Taddy.
Absolutely love that. You don't have to have a word about Gansy Bui. You just
chapeau, Shane.
Big Ben.
Big Ben.
The danger man, Shane Stokes. It is absolutely brilliant. And that really does epitomize just the joy of securing the Gansy Bui. And as you put into the context there, Shane, that this is an historic achievement. Stephen Roach in 87, who went on to win the Tour de France. So no pressure on Ben Healy now. It's early days, it's fair to say.
Yeah, I don't think Ben would. I mean, certainly not this year. I don't think he would. I mean, it's a role he may or may not grow into as time passes. He's 24, and Tadej Pogačar is obviously extremely dominant. But Ben deliberately, actually, at the start of the race, was losing time because his big goal was a stage win. He got that stage win last week and found himself back up in the general classification. He started day 11th overall, almost 4 minutes back. Went on the attack as part of a big 29-rider group. And I think initially he was very much going for the stage win and just the way things, to take a second stage win, but the way things played out, the way the time gaps grew, he made a very conscious decision to switch his objectives and to put everything on a bid for the yellow jersey, which clearly paid off.
Yeah, that's good game management, I suppose, on Ben being able to make those kind of split decisions.
Yeah, he said that because he'd already won a stage, he's ticked that box, and it was very much a huge goal for him. But having got that and then having the opportunity of yellow, he and the team made the decision, OK, this is what we're going to go for. And what was interesting was that with just over 45 kilometres to go, he put in a furious attack. And I'm not quite sure exactly what point he decided to switch objectives, but with that move and with subsequent riding, he was whittling down the group to make it a more manageable group, but also just to ensure that people would be cooperating a bit more. then as things turned out, actually, the other riders realised, okay, well, he's going for yellow. We're just going to sit on him and we're going to go for the stage win, which is precisely what happened at the end. So again, he had to make that decision. Okay, I'm just going to sacrifice the stage, any chance of going for the stage to go for the yellow jersey. And that's precisely how it played out. But yeah, he was very, very delighted at the line, ecstatic with another brilliant performance in the Tour. And it just advances his career even further to take both the stage win and to wear the yellow jersey in this Tour de France.
Well, let's hear from a very happy Ben Healy.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's a fairy tale, you know. Yeah, I mean, if, like I just said, if you told me this before the Tour, I think I wouldn't have believed you, you know. So stage win and yellow jersey, it's just, yeah, incredible and beyond belief, really.
Where did you find the energy again today?
Yeah, I've got some good legs at the moment, you know, and UAE surprisingly let a really big break go up the road, and we had four guys in there, and I've got to really say a massive thank you to Harry Sweeney and Alex Bodan today. You know, they were just incredible, and I'm just so glad I was able to finish it off in the end.
The last Irish rider to wear the and to win it actually was Stephen Roach. What does it mean for you to wear it?
Yeah, I mean, it's some pretty crazy footsteps to follow, isn't it? And I'm just super proud to represent Ireland and wear the yellow jersey for them. And hopefully I can do it some justice.
This morning, I asked you if you were focused on GC. Now, you have to be.
Yeah, I think it'd be rude not to be, you know. Got to respect the jersey. And I'm in quite a nice position now, I guess, to just try and hold on for as long as possible.
So the current holder of the yellow jersey, Ben Healy there. We talk about the big three. Now, Ben Healy leads, and I know, Shane, you've said that this, you know, it is early days and it might be a bit too soon for talking Tour de France competition and tournament wins. However, is Ben Healy now, is he the top four?
He's certainly, you know, Tadej Pogačar and Jonas Vingegaard are clearly the two strongest riders in the race. You know, if you talk about the out-and-out general classification contenders. And Remco Evenepoel, who was third last year, isn't quite thus far at the same level as he has been. It's going to be very interesting to see how things progress, because Ben is riding very strongly. You don't win a stage by the gaps he won last Thursday, taking stage six, and you don't go out and ride as well as he did all through such difficult stages today without having the form. So it's going to be really interesting to see how things play out. You know, in terms of that general classification. So it's going to be quite a shift, because he very much made a decision. He did say to me last year when I chatted to him after the Tour that he would consider going for the general classification at some point, but he felt that it was probably too soon to do that. So it's going to be really interesting to see in this Tour, you know, how he does fare, if he does indeed focus everything on that, or will he decide, you know, in the third week to go for stages again. So yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see.
He's 24. Is he in his prime, or when would his prime be?
No, no. Generally, riders will reach their prime around 28 years of age. So, so he's going to keep building in the next few years. And, you know, what's really important this year is that he's always been a very strong rider. There's a race called the Tour de l'Avenir, which is the under 23 Tour de France. It's kind of an unofficial, but it's you know, it's been won by many of the greats in the past. And Ben was the youngest ever stage winner in that race when he took a stage a good few years ago. So he's always had the talent, but what has happened in recent years is that he's taken some very big results, but he's been a little bit predictable because he's a what's called a diesel engine. So he doesn't have a huge acceleration, but he's got an incredible endurance. So a lot of riders would have taken advantage of that and really let him do all the pace setting. And he's lost wins because of that, because he wouldn't have the same snap that they do, the same explosive acceleration. But what he did do over the winter, you know, being mindful of that, is he worked on that explosivity, and also he watched a lot of race footage to try and learn the tactics a little bit better and to be less predictable about when he was going to attack, because he tended to attack from the front and try to burn people off his wheel. So he's grown a lot physically over the years, but I think more importantly, he has refined really his strength and mixed it with experience that he's been gaining, obviously, but also this new tactical awareness and then the greater bit of explosivity. And I think that's all come together really well in this Tour.
Does he have the teammates? Is the quality there to have him somewhat in contention or still be pushing with the people around him?
Yeah, I don't see the team as having the same horsepower as the likes of the UAE team, Emirates squad of Tadej Pogačar, or indeed the Visma Elisa bike team of Jonas Vingegaard. The EFH Education Easy Post team, which previously actually Dan Martin rode with. They were Garmin under that that sponsorship. So it does have a history of Irish riders. Archie Ryan is there at the moment. Ryan Mullen has been there in the past, and Darren Rafferty is there. So there's a big Irish history within the team. They're more seen as a kind of a plucky team of stage hunters and slight underdogs and that. So I think if it went to a head-to-head with the other big teams, with Pogacar's team and Jonas Vingegaard's team, they wouldn't match them in terms of horsepower, but they'd be absolutely inspired in the days ahead to defend yellow. And they'll absolutely give everything to try and keep him in yellow as long as possible.
Well, here's hoping he does remain in yellow for as long as possible. A brilliant day for Ben Healy. Shane, just before I let you go, actually, we mentioned 87. We're rolling back the years now for some of our younger listeners to perhaps, and putting into context, just how big a deal was it, Stephen Roach winning the Tour de France?
Oh, it was massive. And you know, I think the big thing about that was that Irish sport was a lot less international back then. I mean, big, big results were really quite rare across all sorts of sports. You remember the big celebrations when Ireland even qualified for the World Cup, the soccer, and that. Yeah. It was, so we weren't used to winning. It was really quite rare for Irish to win huge competitions abroad. So when Stephen Roach won the Tour de France, there was massive crowds on O'Connell Street. He came down on an open-topped bus, and the place was absolutely crammed with people. It really was massive. It was front page of all the newspapers and probably quite a few of the rest of the pages as well. So, yeah, there was a massive buzz about it. And I think every second person had a bike and was going up the road, you know, imagining themselves to be either Stephen Roach or Sean Kelly for years after that. So it was absolutely huge.
Brilliant stuff. Shane Stokes at Avello Website, thank you so much for taking the call, and a massive congratulations to Ben Healy. Austin O'Malley and Alan Collier still with us. Want to reflect more, perhaps get their views on Ben Healy, and indeed debate our weekend sporting highlights. Stick with us here in Game On.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Well, we usually start the show with debating our weekend sporting highlights of a Monday, but rightly so, Ben Healy got top billing this evening. And you were nodding along there when I asked the question of Shane Stokes about putting that in the context with Stephen Roach in 87, like a brilliant occasion. Would you be a cycling man?
Yeah, no, listen, just listening to Shane there, obviously, like growing up in the 80s, I'm of that vintage. And I was just thinking it there, like that's brilliant from the perspective of that what he's done, because, you know, he's an opportunity to reconnect a younger audience with cycling. And I grew up in that era, and I can distinctly remember Stephen Roach in that white and blue jersey and then going on into the different colour jerseys, but also Sean Kelly in that green jersey. Mm. It was iconic moments, like we were glued to it. And like, you know, I suppose you could see, you know, that the attritional nature of the sport as well, but like, and I think Stephen Roach, I remember, well, like, I think he might have won what they called the Triple Crown that year going back, in terms of he won the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, and I think is the World Road Race in 87 or around there. I think it's called the Triple Crown. So he was incredible.
Knowledge, Austin.
I remember that distinctly, because I remember popping up even when I was younger. I think it said he was from Dundrum in Dublin, and me being a culture going, I wonder where's Dundrum in Dublin. You know, I was like, wow, that sounds very exotic.
That was the countryside back in the 80s.
Yeah, was it? Okay. Well, I could be wrong. I remember Sean Kelly, I think it was Carrigan-Shure, and I remember thinking to myself, wow, yeah. But I distinctly remember those popping on the old television. We were watching them, and I was like, wow, yeah, you're hooked for that. But then I suppose you get disconnected because there's no Irish involved in it as you grow older. But I'm always keeping an eye on it, so I just think it's incredible that he's done that and he's in the yellow jersey.
Yeah, he became
Gansey Bui.
Yeah. Oh, chapeau. He became the second of only three cyclists to win the Triple Crown of victories in the Tour de France and the Giro general classification, plus the World Road Race Championship.
Yeah, I thought it was
Eddie Merckx and Tadej Pogacar, of course, who was still racing. So Roach's rise coincided with that of fellow Irishman.
Eddie Merckx was the
he was the man.
I remember that, right? God, you're bringing back the memories now.
You made the point off air as well of, and use Ken Doherty as an example, that there's people kind of watching sport, and there was a good example in football even that I had of people like, geez, he's a great pundit, you know, he's a good speaker. It's like, no, he's a brilliant athlete as well. I know Kelly does a bit for commentary for TNT, I think it is, as well, and he's brilliant with all these stories. He goes off and one is just that dulcet Irish accent as well. But it's good to see kind of and relate to the athlete that they were.
100% Shane, because as you say, people forget that, and especially with the achievements that they've had. They weren't run of the mill athletes. They were winning world championships and obviously Stephen Roach there as well. So it's a younger audience. You kind of understand it a little bit, but people should always maybe look into what they actually achieved themselves in their career.
Yeah,
those people in particular. And even he mentioned Shane that time around the 80s. There might may have not, like Dennis Taylor won the World Championship in 85. That famous final against Davis. So there's probably still a lot going on. Like, we always talk about how we overachieve as a nation, which we obviously do because sport mad. But yeah, when you think of the things we do achieve, but it's been happening a while. Like, it's not like a new thing in the last 5-10 years that we've been overachieving. Like, it's
a land of overachievers.
It really
and
is.
Saints and scholars.
Saints and scholars. Yeah. Sporting,
whatever you're having yourself.
Yeah. No, it is. And no, I say that, and I have to achieve, but of like the poets, the writers, the athletes that we've produced, and that might lead us on nicely to our weekend sporting highlights, and perhaps late Friday night in the early hours of Saturday morning, some people's sporting highlights might have been Katie Taylor winning against Amanda Serrano.
Is it yours, Austin?
It's up there, without a doubt. It's up there, but I think out of all of it over the weekend, and Katie's is phenomenal. I think is what she's done, and I think what really shone out to me on that one was just her post-match interview and how clever she was in terms of what she said, that what she had learned from the previous two fights, and not going toe-to-toe with Serrano this time and not letting her get her feet set this time. So I suppose you're always looking at, maybe from a coaching perspective, for someone that, you know, didn't become comfortable and certainly like was still looking back at ways to better herself in terms of performance and victory. So I just thought there was a lot in that. But obviously there was a lot of football on as well. But my sporting highlight was one maybe from like a lesser known sport, but I thought there was something popped up over the weekend yesterday. Ethan Rafferty.
Yes, road bowling.
Road bowling.
Go man, Austin. Yeah.
I saw the photo.
Did you?
Incredible. Online.
That's mine. I just think there's two pieces to this. Number one, it's an All-Ireland title that he's after winning for road bowling, which is incredible. He's won it on the back of, I think he won the intermediate before that. So I think he's become one of the only road bowlers that has done this. I could stand corrected on
first,
that.
He's the first road bowler to win the All-Ireland intermediate and senior titles in successive years.
Wow. So that's but the other bit that I love this is, this guy came under serious pressure 2 weeks ago in Croke Park. His kickout got dismantled. You know, could arguably have walked away and put his head down and thought, I need to go to ground here for a month or 6 weeks. But it just goes to show the nature and the character of the guy, that dust himself off, went down to Cork, won an All-Ireland, in what you'd necessarily say maybe a minority sport, but yeah,
I think it's very fair to say it is.
Yeah, it is, and it's an incredible sport.
That's not,
it's
no disrespect.
No, and it's indigenous to Ireland. It's one of the longest. It's going back to the 1700s. But it's an incredible sport, and it's actually, to see it play out is incredible as well. When you see that steel ball, like it's whatever 7 I think inches in circumference, and that was 28 or 29 ounces in weight. Like, so it's an incredible feat. I just think it's worth mentioning, and fair play to him for having the character to stand up and go again and do that.
No, I'm delighted you mentioned it, actually. No, it's brilliant. I think it's huge in Cork and Armagh. I know he's from Armagh. I think they're the hotbeds of road bowling. But the pictures, I saw the photo online.
Amazing.
It's so immersive.
Yeah.
It's like the rally photos when you see the car spinning around and everyone kind of converges.
And they're only 40 or 50 metres away. And this thing I think in old Ireland they called it the long shots or long shoots. Okay. Long shots is the name. There's actually a guy, Fintan Lane has a book wrote about road bowling, and it's called Long Shots, the history of road bowling in Ireland, which is it's meant to be
Long Bullets.
Long Bullets, is it? Yeah,
Long Bullets, a history of road bowling.
Is that what
Ireland.
It is? Yeah. I think it's worth to
Austin
read.
Austin has really shown his country side. Road bowling. I've never heard of it in my life.
Have you not? Well, no. I tell you, do you know where it first came to my eye line? Was I remember. There was a small pocket of Mayo, and it's actually a little place called Ahagour. I remember going out, I have an aunt living in it, and on Sundays when you're younger, you go out there, and driving over to her house, there would be crowds on the road. And I remember asking my dad, "And what's going on there?" And he was like, it's road bowling, it's a thing out here. And I was like, all right. So that's where it first came into my eye line.
Fair enough. That's good, Austin, yeah.
It's brilliant. Well, of course, we're Dundrum now, Austin, as well, aren't you?
Yeah. I had to get to Lewis there.
No, it is absolutely brilliant. Irish sport in which competitors attempt to take the fewest throws to propel a metal ball along a predetermined course of country roads. The sport originated in Ireland, as you mentioned, Austin, is mainly played in counties Armagh and Cork.
Okay.
Is governed by the Voluntary Irish Road Bowling Association, or as I'm reliably told in some parts, road bowling. Our producer, Andrew, informs you as well to give it its proper... In the vernacular.
In the vernacular,
perhaps as well. So the bullet or the bowl is a solid iron cannonball. So that's the it's brilliant. No, it is. It's absolutely brilliant as well. And massive congratulations to Katie Taylor. Massive congratulations to Eden Rafferty. Alan Colley, what caught your
eye? I have a couple
weekend?
Of obscure ones as well.
The more obscure, the better.
Yeah, I do actually. And it just kind of gives you an insight into my Sunday afternoon as well, because I was waiting on the match yesterday and the tennis final, and both were clashing at 4 o'clock. But in the build up to that, I got stuck on the golf, but not the golf with the Scottish Open, the women's major that was on before that.
Okay.
And the most unbelievable finish that I've seen from a golf tournament in a long, long time. So Grace Kim, who's an Australian golfer, was two shots behind going down the 18th, which was a par five.
Yeah.
So obviously needed an eagle to get herself into a playoff. And I'm not joking, Shane, she hit the most unbelievable shot from the fairway in going for the green to put herself in a position to get the eagle.
Okay.
And even she was playing with the girl who was leading the tournament, and even her face told the story itself, because she couldn't believe the shot that Grace Kim had just hit. So she went on the green, got her eagle. Yeah. The other girl ended up parring the hole, because she kind of played it conservatively, thinking a par will do me here. So she ended up getting the par, went to the playoff. So unbelievable shot. Then she goes down the first playoff hole was the 18th. So back down the 18th again, goes in the water. Right? So now she's a shot behind. So she's taken her fourth shot. Yeah. Again, the other girl was clever. Plays it conservatively. She's on the green in three.
Right.
So it looks like she has a chance of birdie, but will definitely get a par. She holds off the green from her chip in on her fourth shot, Grace Kim. So then the girl had to get a par then. She got a birdie then. So they squared the hole back down the 18th and won it on the second playoff hole. It was the most unbelievable finish I've seen to a golf tournament in a long, long time, considering she needed an eagle on the 18th.
The Evian Championship.
And
I think she's lowly ranked, isn't she? Or is she?
No, I think she's one of the better ones.
Is she one of the better ones?
It's her first major, though, which is an incredible achievement.
What a way to win a first major.
That's what I'm saying. It was the most unbelievable finish. Then I was Saturday afternoon.
Right.
Anisimova, and Austin raises a good point there, not about Ethan Rafferty and what he achieved, but the fact that he was able to bounce back so soon after. To lose 6-0 in a tennis major, and Stephen will obviously fill you in more about it in better detail, but the speech afterwards was unbelievable. And again, Stephen will give you the girl's backstory, which is remarkable in itself, even to find herself where she is right now and achieving, I suppose, the achievement in getting to the final itself. But to lose 6-0, get absolutely destroyed.
6-love, I believe, in tennis
six
parlance.
Sorry.
Stephen
six
Higgins, Stephen
sorry,
Higgins
Stephen.
is texting me here.
Come on, lads. It's a good story and you're pulling me up, Stephen.
I didn't say anything. You're in flow.
Thanks, Austin.
100%.
See how Austin's good by me.
A man who devotes a lot of his career to cross court view. I'll give the website a plug. You know, we have to get it in.
And Stephen's view is the only view I go by. But come on, Stephen, let me have my moment.
Hung you out to dry.
Okay, six love. But the speech to her mum was absolutely incredible because of the backstory. So I think that deserves a mention as well. And hopefully, sometimes they say you have to lose one to win one. Yeah. I think she will bounce back. And then the last one, and I have a bee in my bonnet about this, Shane, sorry. But the greatest Gaelic footballer of all time.
Yeah.
I'm putting it out there, right? And I think everybody, a lot are in agreement.
Greatest ever. Hands down. No debate.
Greatest ever.
Right, okay.
1-9.
Yeah.
Unplayable. Untouchable. Putting points over from all angles.
Yeah.
Two pointers, goals, single points, layoffs, assists.
Celebrations.
You name it. Celebrations, fist pumps, signing autographs after the match.
But man of the people.
But was it man of the match?
Man of the people.
But was it man of the match?
Man of the people, though.
Ticked all the boxes.
You don't need these individual accolades in the team
game. I love Tomás, right?
Yeah.
Kieran Whelan, and the boys explained it afterwards.
You weren't here for a right of reply, by the way.
No, but the boys, I have huge respect for the boys, that's fine.
Yeah.
But to give it to Joe O'Connor, and Joe O'Connor was brilliant,
absolutely
brilliant, to be fair to him, and he stood up, he was amazing. Sean Kavanagh made a great point, and here's something that I'm leading to in terms of sporting individuals. He made a great point and a great line that we almost take him for granted, because we see him do this so often, but you should never ever take him for granted in what he's doing. Because you watched the match yesterday and it was a great game and Donegal and all that, but there's nobody doing what David Clifford does on an individual basis more often than not. Like, it's phenomenal how good he is.
You'd agree?
Yeah, I know. Look, he's an artist. I mean, I think we're really lucky to be kind of coming up in this time to... I think the GAA are so lucky to have a player like that as well, in terms of he's box office. Some of his statistics at the moment, even, he's averaged 10 from play over the last three games, which I think is unheard of in Championship as well. But I mean, just the level he's at and what he's doing. Even there was a couple of cameos, I thought, in that Tyrone game where he came under serious pressure. That 2-pointer that he kicked off, that he took off the ground and turned. Unbelievable. Even the goal, you know, that little dummy bounce that he has got to go on. Like, he's doing things in the game that others aren't doing it. And he's, you know, he's such a big, rangy guy, and some of the stuff that he's doing so quick and so polished, and he's just an artist. And I don't think he should be taken for granted. No, absolutely not. We're so lucky in the game to have him.
I don't think it's taken for granted, though. You'd have to give him man of the match all the time, then.
But if he is the man of the match, give him man of the match. You can't say, oh, well, we won't give it to him because he won it last week. Mm-hmm. If Messi scores a hat-trick every week like he was doing, you're waxing lyrical about him, and rightly so. You have Djokovic winning majors left, right and centre, wax lyrical about him. If the fellas are doing it on a consistent basis, you can only say what you're seeing in front of your eyes and not say, oh, well, we better not give it to him this week because he won it last week and he won it the week before as well.
No, that's fair.
But if he scores 1-9 and he's literally unplayable in the semi-final.
Yeah, and your team have a very commanding semi-final. No, I completely get your point. But Joe Connor played well.
He played very well.
He's not doing what David Clifford does. But he's doing an awful lot of different stuff, and he's at a level as well.
I think he was very good.
I thought he was exceptional, and he has been the heartbeat of a lot of those Kerry performances. When things are a bit sticky,
yeah,
and that's that sort of darker arts, dirty stuff out around that middle eight there. Even watching the games, like there are moments where he's, you know, that they're momentum swingers that he does, like balls that he wins, even that couple of turnovers that he won, those knifing runs. So I can see where the guys are, like, he's imprinted in the totality of the game, and he's like what he's giving Kerry out around that middle is, like, without him, you could arguably say some of the supply might not be getting into Clifford to weave his wand.
He's not doing it on his own. Yeah. Of course, I know that. Yeah. I understand that. And give him his dues. No disrespect to Joe Connor. He's outstanding.
He's having an incredible season.
But I just think if you've someone who's doing things on a regular basis that we don't see on a regular basis from everybody else.
No, that's a very... You mentioned the dark arts. Actually, speaking of the dark arts, Brendan Devaney is on the line as well. We're going to just segue into our Gaelic football chat. Alan, you can stay around as well. We might get Brendan's weekend sporting highlights. We'll go for a very fluid Monday show here. Brendan, I don't know how much of that conversation you were listening into, but where do you stand on this? I don't know how we're starting off our Gaelic football chat with a man of the match debate, but however, here we are now. David Clifford and Joe O'Connor, Brendan.
Yeah, that's a dark art. I was a purist. People were turning the dark arts on me. I was like Collie, unbelievable.
You're right,
talented.
Brendan.
They're trying to shut us down. You know what I mean, Alan? Me and you were born up cut of the same cloth.
Absolutely, Brendan. You tell them.
Just artistry, yeah.
We know Clifford like he's one of our own.
Talking about man the match, you're on about O'Connor. You know, I was down pitch side at the weekend doing stuff, and O'Connor comes out in the pitch. And he's got these kind of shark eyes. Like, he'd kind of scare you just to stand beside him, never mind play beside him. He's a bull of a man. And you talk about, I mean, we have this in both codes, you know, soccer, Gaelic, and that, like the engine room. Like, who is the player that makes it happen? Is it the player that's in bowling in the middle, winning balls, setting up play for the brilliance of Clifford? Who is the most important in the team? But of course, yeah, by and large, Clifford will always get the plaudits. And just looking at Clifford the last day, what scares me about him is, you know, he was rash with a couple of shots early on in the game, but it doesn't matter. Clifford can do whatever he wants. You know, when I was playing, if I was rash with a couple of shots and next thing you think, I better get the next one or I could be good and hooked at half time, whereas Clifford's just kind of lording it. So he basically, it's only a matter of what he's going to score and how well he's going to play. And that is the danger for the opposition. And when he scored that goal and he was celebrating the crowd, and I think with the new rules as well, the space that he's getting now, it's time for players to come to absolutely shine. Because if this was last season, Tyrone would have three around him the same way. Remember the Derry game last year? It was such a negative game, and I was looking at Clifford thinking, like, why would you be bothered? Like, but here he is now, and he's in the zone. He's a dangerous man.
Brendan, I'm glad you said that, because I actually said this here with Austin a wee while ago, that with the new rules and the changes, it obviously the forward players, the flair players, the match winners, if you like, will flourish, which is great to see. Now, we'll never know unless David Clifford comes out and says it himself, but I actually thought towards the end of last season, with the way the game was going and how kind of stagnant and horrible it was to play and double up on him, treble up on him, that he was considering maybe like jacking this, like, because he was getting no protection. No, I'm not saying you have to get protection, but just in terms of the enjoyment of the game that I'm sure he wants to play for, like what we seen yesterday, that was all being taken away from him.
Yeah, he could have went and played somewhere handily, like the League of Ireland. He probably 30 goals a season or something. Can you imagine him? I'd say he'd
I think
be
he did play a lot of soccer when he was young. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, he's like a half though, apparently. Yeah.
Really?
Well, I heard centre half.
It's a good point, Alan, because I was looking at a lot of games. I found it hard even watching. And the Flair players were, if they came out and even got their hands on the ball, people were pushing them. If they came inside, they were surrounded by people. And it was really, it was probably, you know, it was just mass defending. There was no actual art to it. You know, when I used to play your corner back or full back, like, it was you and him, that was it. And I'll tell you, you did well to get your hands on that ball. And that seems to have flipped a lot now. There's a lot of defenders can't really handle one-on-one, but back then that's the way it was. You know, you had the two sides to the game, but then when it became the blanket defence, you're right, I was looking at these guys thinking, you can't be enjoying your football. So listen, hope he doesn't enjoy himself too much in the final.
Oh, you Jimmy will have a plan.
Oh, he will.
What will be the plan to suffocate him, so Brendan?
Well, I listen, obviously Trome were way too wide open. Like, listen, see, I didn't know what Trome we were going to see going into the game. We were hoping, like, it was funny because quarterfinals the last few years had been quite poor, you know, quite a few games, but we had good quarterfinals. The Tyrone-Dublin game was the only one maybe didn't really catch fire. But after Tyrone, we should have probably beaten Armagh, Ulster. They had beaten Donegal and Balba Faye, but we probably hadn't seen yet, you know, the real kind of team coming together. We had seen flashes of it, so we were hoping for a big performance. And as it was, Kerry came with a big performance. Now, Tyrone did start well in the game, but once the game opened up and Kerry got under their flow, Hampsey was left exposed completely. And when you're not fast enough to take a forward, you're in trouble. And that's any forward. Now, when you're David Clifford in, so Tyrone couldn't seem to get set back in, couldn't get deep. Now, there's a risk reward with that. With Donegal, if they come back in and they defend the numbers, you're leaving yourself prone to people like Sean O'Shea coming in the loop and Potty and everybody else. But you need to negate his danger first. So I think you'll see Donegal looking to plug up the gaps, try and get at least one man back spare, because one-on-one, and listen, McCall's having an unbelievable season, and he'll say, give Clifford to me, I want to mark him, I want to take him. But listen, with a load of room in a fast-playing pitch like Croke Park, you do need to try and get someone else in to help out when it's David.
Yeah, very much so. Austin, the question was posed whether or not Kerry would reach the peak that they did in that period against Armagh, where they rattled off 14 unanswered points. They probably didn't reach the peak, but they didn't need to reach the peak.
Yeah, no, they didn't. And like, as Brendan said there, Tyrone started well. They got a press on Shane Ryan's kick out and took them a while to figure out, but they did. And I just thought Tyrone that second half, they kind of just dissolved away. Like, you know, I suppose the Tellin statistic in that second half, they went 20 odd minutes without a score, you know, and Kerry rattled off 14 scores. I actually just thinking, looking back at it, and I was thinking, and maybe I'd be interested in maybe what Brendan thinks this as well, but Tyrone, I thought, lacked a lot of leadership in that second half. And even up top in their front six, like, they're all quite diminutive. Are Tyrone missing something different at 14, like a big kind of ball winner a la Michael Murphy with a presence in that? Because they look like that they can be shut down, and even what they brought in from the bench as well didn't look like to threaten either. So I think they've, over the winter, I think they've a bit of thinking to do in terms of that kind of front six and just something different to give opposition.
Brendan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Listen, Matty Donnelly in theory would be that player, but particularly like against Dublin, and when he does go inside, Tyrone tend not to kick it.
Yeah.
They run it, and then they were given very short ball. And in fairness to Kerry fullback line, you know, they were snapping away, you know, Foley, particularly Casey. He marked him at times. He was dropping in Michael Holm, you know, Murphy, and the battle that Foley had. He took McCurry out of the game. So they seemed to be a lot tighter and were snapping on everybody, whereas Kerry were getting space. They were taking players wide. They kept using Clifford, obviously, was the main aim. But I agree with you. You know, the big Fitzpatrick done well in midfield and that. But you're right, that leadership thing, which every team needs, that drive, just it seemed to be a very strange season with Tyrone. Now, we thought with Malachy Rourke going in there, he would sort that out, because, you know, even with the likes of McGeary in there, and obviously, you know, Petey Hart came on, the likes of Donnelly, like, there's a huge amount of experience in that team. But again, even you mentioned kickouts here, you know, Niall Morgan didn't have his best of season. Everything seemed to go wrong for Tyrone as well. I mean, even Rory Kenevan hitting that 2-point, the ref blew the whistle, up steps Morgan. Morgan normally knocks him over to sleep, put it wide. Everything seemed to go wrong. This taking the hand away from Kerry. Kerry brought a level of intensity and grit into that game. And, you know, Sean O'Shea, it was interesting just watching him being close to him there. And of course, he's an All-Ireland semi-final. But the work rate of him, you know, you look at the game he had the last day. He didn't have the same scoring game today, but the work rate the Kerry lads was putting in all over the pitch, you know, they really seemed to go after Tyrone in a way that Tyrone couldn't seem to handle. And, you know, at the end of the day, they ran out easy winners. And after the brilliant quarterfinals we had, there were two very lopsided semis. But listen, I can't see there being any big scores between teams in the final set up for a cracker.
No, very much is. The other semi-final, so Austin O'Malley, Donegal against Meath, 326 to 15 points. They just absorbed the kickouts and everything Meath were. Their accuracy was lacking. It was disappointing to see Meath. They had a bad day. It's been a good year for Meath football. I think that's a fair summation. But for Donegal, they were just on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it has been a really good year in terms of a development cycle for Meath. But look, I mean, I was there yesterday and just, you know, close down to pitch side. And look, it was just a demolition job, I thought, by Donegal. I just thought, looking at it, I said, there are levels. And sometimes you look at games and Donegal just had levels in every aspect, I thought, of their game in terms of their defensive set, their transition, in particular their transition. It was incredible at times, even in that second half, how relentless it was, the support play, the off the shoulder running and all of that. So I just thought that they absorbed a little bit from Meath in that first half. Meath, look, I mean, they left so much on the table going in at half time. They had those kind of 6-2 pointers that they'd missed, but their execution overall, they had 15 wides, they were down at 37%. Donegal were up and close at 70 and so on. Donegal hit 326, I think 23 from play. When you look at that, 1-2 pointer Michael Murphy into the hill from that free, which was actually it was extraordinary early doors, and he hit that. You know, he's a colossus, but I don't know if anyone get it, but there was a picture, all the Meath fans behind the goal in the hill, they were actually like a shoal of fish or a shoal of heron, you know, with their hands up waving looking into it. And I just thought, at a moment you were looking at it, he just dead-eyed at one stage, he was looking into it, and he just took the chin in and bang, over. And it was those little signals. But look, just it was frightening there in the second half. And I think if there was anything that epitomised the Donegal performance, I thought it was Finbarr Ortiz winning that turnover on Curtis, snaffled it up. And the way they transitioned that ball down the field to Kieran Moore's goal. To me, if you were to coach a team on transition and quick and angles and running and keeping the ball in centre channel where most goals come from, it was just absolute textbook. So I just thought they were on a different level, and then they ran the bench and all of that that they unloaded there at the end. It was merciless, I thought.
Merciless, actually. That's a very, very good word to describe it. And it's mad to think how young Finbarr Ortiz is still as well.
Incredible steady guy. You could know from his interview afterwards and even before, and I've heard him speak, you can just see that it's all about the team.
You mentioned the influence of Michael Murphy. Brendan Devaney, does Michael Murphy get away with too much?
No. Well, in terms of what? Would you be putting any arrows on him now?
There's a narrative going around in certain Gaelic Games circles, Brendan, that perhaps he isn't penalised as strictly as perhaps he should be.
Hey, every game, Shane, the Meath whole crowd, now the colour there was unbelievable, of course, everybody wearing the same colours. Meath fans were brilliant. The noise they were making now, in fairness, and they kept going for ages, even like a 35 minutes of a complete battering, really, in that game. But, you know, you look at Murphy. Murphy seems to go back, and every game he throws one hard tackle at somebody, and there's a massive furor about it. It's as if this is building. There always seems to be a potential card coming, and the opposition and everybody want to try and ruffle him. Now, I don't think there's any kind of malice in him. He just comes in very hard. Listen, he's too important a player. He's too smart for that. But he does like to mix it. You know, you often hear about Michael, you know, at training and all that. Come on, bring it on kind of stuff. And I think Rafferty was getting stuck into him. And Rafferty's famous for the hard hits himself. So maybe one came his way yesterday. But listen, he got up and got on with it. He's a no-nonsense type guy. But, you know, Murphy, the 2014, obviously, final where Kerry beat Donegal. You have McBerty, McHugh and Murphy still there from that team, and their performances yesterday were brilliant. I mean, McHugh had one of his best games. Murphy's in line for man of the match every game he plays with Donegal, and then when McBerty came off the bench, he was brilliant. So it's interesting, that's the tie-in from 2014, and they're still at the peak of their powers.
Yeah, Paddy McBerty actually mentioned we've massively underachieved since 14. Jim has raised standards. Would you agree, Austin?
Look, it's so evident in terms of when you, like, I stood here in this studio, was it 2 years ago, and I remember, or was it 3 years ago, and there was a bit of the debacle in Donegal and that, and I remember saying it here, like, the Donegal still had the players to go deep into an All-Ireland Championship and that, but just to see the way that he has turned the ship around, the buy-in that he's got, he has re-energised the whole county. He has got a brilliant connection between fans and the team. And what he has put in place, you know, it's incredible, the turnaround, really, when you see the buy-in and what guys are doing for him. But also the level of conditioning and fitness that he is, you know, all his key pillars are they're just primed. And I thought yesterday, like, they were at the zenith of the peak of their powers. But that's the physicality stuff, that's the game plan stuff. But you can tell in the interviews afterwards where, you know, the culture that's been built, the standards of excellence that have been set, and also the vision. You know, they're all referencing one more step. We're all in this together. You know, we all do our job for the team and so on. So that's clear. Like, that messaging, I'd say, is so simple and consistent in Jim. And that's the way he goes about things in connecting people to that vision and then really, really doubling down on standards. And you can see that they're just really playing for him. And that's the goal, isn't it?
It's going to be difficult to dampen expectations now in your neck of the woods, Brendan.
Oh yes, listen, we're all going to go buck mad. We're good at that here. There we go.
You have experience. Listen,
bring me with you, Brendan.
Don't forget about the lads.
I know. I was talking to Benny Tierney the last day, and he was saying, "Oh, you study goal, boys. Like, we were Vauxhall Conference, you were Premier League partiers." I was like, "I says, well, that's a great title for us, I news of all the ulcers." But yeah, listen, Austin's right. You mentioned Jim. I mean, the Bulls in the county and the respect of these boys. You're on about Rody McCall. They're eights every game, Patton, and listen, throughout the team. Yesterday, you know, McFadden, the performance at midfield with Langan. Of course, a half forward line, Shane O'Donnell, Thompson. You mentioned Kieran Murray's goal. I mean, unbelievable. Finn Barody, young footballer of the year already, and not to mention the 2-11 from the full forward line and then the bench. So Donegal were a bit out of sorts, Shane, in the group stages. There's no doubt in that, in terms of the performances, particularly against Tyrone and Mayo. They weren't really themselves coming through the championship, but now, since the second half, particularly against Monaghan and where they were yesterday, they're coming in and flying form, as is Kerry. So listen, it's set up for a big one.
Yeah, perhaps this will be the perfect All-Ireland showcase, and new rules, contrasting styles, and some big star names as well. 51552 is the text number. Can you tell Alan, says Joseph, that BBC NI showed the game and Mickey Hart gave it to David Clifford, man of the match?
There you go.
Just on also the Tailteann Cup, massive congratulations to Kildare. Ruby's not here, but he'd be scolding as if we weren't to mention that. So Kildare, of course, Tailteann Cup champions, a hard-fought win over Limerick. Limerick's been a brilliant story this year as well. But can this be a genuine springboard for Kildare football now?
I think so. And I think the important thing is that they've secured Sam Maguire football for next year, obviously. But to win a national trophy in Croke Park for Kildare is really, really important. They haven't won one. And it's I think it was 2012, a Division 2 title since they 2012 a Division 2 title since they've won a national honours in Croke Park, and they've had some tough days. They're a side that are developing. Brian Flanagan, you know, he's bringing them on. They've still a lot of work to do, and I'm sure they're pre-season and that. But like, you have to, and full credit to Limerick. I thought Limerick were superb on the day as well, and they gave Kildare a real stern test and gave them the fright of their lives there at the end in terms of that last ditch approach. Like, I think it was Dara Murray that got a shot off, and Brian Byrne managed to just get a fingertips to put over the bar. Otherwise, it would have gone to full time. But you'd be hoping that Kildare would use this as a springboard now and kick on.
Yeah, no, very much so. And commiserations, but also congratulations to Limerick in a way.
Because, absolutely, because they've had a fantastic season. And Jimmy Lee has done an incredible job there. So they're on the rise as well.
Very much so. 51552 as mentioned, it's a text number. S. Kurt texts in, Damien Duff for the Dublin job. Well, there was a crossover with Jim McGuinness, I suppose. He had a bit of a soccer spell in the past as well. We're taking a short ad break. We did, actually, just before we take a short ad break, Paul from Sligo texts us in. Have either of your guests ever heard of a game called Horseshoes? Paul from Sligo, is this a Sligo?
Well, it's not a Sligo one, Paul.
No,
definitely not.
Horseshoes? We were talking about road bowling
is
the context
area.
Is that
the one where they sling horseshoes over a steel pin or a pin or a hook?
Because exactly what it says in the tin, I believe, yeah. Is it? But if you're asking those questions, we're like, no, we haven't heard of horseshoes. Yeah.
Tell Paul I'd be in Sligo this weekend for a game of horseshoes.
For a game of horseshoes. Okay. We're taking a short ad break. Alan's going to chat about football. Stephen Higgins is going to join us to reflect on the Wimbledon finals as well. Stick with us here in Game On.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, you're very welcome back to the show. Stephen Higgins is going to be chatting tennis very, very shortly. Just briefly, we did mention it in your highlights. The Club World Cup final, Alan Cawley, were you not astounded? A big win for Chelsea, presented by the Cup by Donald Trump and Gianni Infantino. A great day for association football, Alan.
Wasn't for me, Shane. I was watching, well, I was working the Women's Euros last night, so France and Netherlands. So I didn't see the game. Mm. I haven't watched 1 minute of that tournament. I'm dead against it for all the reasons that I've outlined here many times. These lads shouldn't be playing football under summer holidays, and they're playing football under summer holidays for all the wrong reasons. And it tells you, I suppose, the position that football finds itself in, Shane, as the wider out playing football during these times. It was only 3-4 weeks ago that both these teams were in European finals.
Yeah.
And European finals always signal the end of the season for me. And to have them out in America playing off for another 3-4 weeks on top of the seasons that they've had. And I made the point yesterday, I think you'll only see the repercussions of this in 6 months' time, maybe. Because if you've the likes of Chelsea fighting it out for a European place, I don't see them going for a league title next year in the Premier League, but fighting it out for the top four. And at some stage, it's going to take its toll on that squad when they're literally playing all year round. Now, people might argue to have the squad to cater for it. I don't think they do. PSG, potentially, because they're playing in an easier league, if you like, domestically. Yeah. So they'll be able to cater for it. But I just think it's a tournament for all the wrong reasons, and I've had no interest in it. I've stuck to me guns and I haven't watched 1 minute. And that's hard for me, Shane, when you think of me watching two flies going up a
wall.
Well,
the Women's Euros has been on. So you've had your fix of football, and there's been a bit of League of Ireland. You're heading up to Belfast on Wednesday as well.
And a tournament with substance that matters, the Women's Euros, which is brilliant.
Very much so. The quarterfinals confirmed: Sweden, England, Norway, Italy, France, Germany, Spain, Switzerland. Just very briefly on that, Alan, I know you've been across the tournament now. We know the quarterfinal pairings. It's been a decent watch so far.
Very good. And now we're down to the business end as well, Shane. And I suppose because there's only 16 teams in it, obviously, we're down to the last eight, so you're into crackers really straight away from the quarterfinal stage. So it's a tough one to call. Spain would have been the favourites at the start of the competition. England suffered a bump the first night, but they've bounced back really well, beating the Netherlands, and obviously
easier side of the draw, finishing second in their group.
Yeah, it's just the way it's played out, because nobody probably would have seen Germany losing to Sweden as well, Shane. But Sweden are strong. I wouldn't be underestimating Sweden. I did the game against Poland the other night. Now Poland weren't up to much, but Sweden are very strong. It's Gerhardsen's last tournament as well. He's put in 8 years as the manager there, and to have some top players in Blackstenius, Rolfo, Angeldal is brilliant in midfield. So Sweden will be a tough nut to crack for England. I'd still, looking at France last night, I think France are very, very strong.
Okay.
And that they're playing Germany. I know Germany suffered a setback, but Germany, I still think France will get by them, but it won't be an easy game. But I think France are very strong.
Okay, Mark Langdon will join us for more football chat tomorrow, and we'll get into the League of Ireland in detail with Paul Corry as well. Just to mention, FIFA's hailing of its Club World Cup has been labelled nothing more than fiction by the president of Leading Players Global Union. FIFA Pro, so that backs up your point as well, Al. And Cove Ramblers are under new ownership once again, following US-based group Digital Athlete Ventures taking 90% stake in the club. This comes after FC32 dissolved, which only took control in October last year.
Game on. Tennis.
But Stephen Higgins joins the conversation now of Cross Court View after you scolding Alan Colley in early for the 6-0 shout, but however, we'll gloss over that. We'll gloss over that. Did you enjoy the Wimbledon finals? And as a man who has a passion for the sport and who follows it in detail religiously, did you appreciate the finals and who won them? Or you can see where this question is going. Is there a bit in you that says this is really bad for the sport, considering for the first time in Wimbledon history both the men's and women's champions have served suspensions for banned substances?
Oh, that's a serious one to open. Yeah, I think if you look at the actual cases on their merits, I think it's always really important when you talk about doping cases. They release a report, the ITIA, the International Tennis Integrity Agency. They're well worth reading. Like, they're not particularly long. I know people aren't as sad as me about tennis stuff, but...
No, but that's why I pose the question, because you follow the sport in so much detail, and that's why I love reading the stuff from Cross Court View, and I'm not just saying that because you're standing across from me, but to kind of have that level of knowledge is really intriguing.
Yeah, I think if you read the cases themselves, so for Jannik Sinner, famously, like, the most ridiculous story ever of his physio was using cream on a cut finger that had a steroid called Clostobal in it. It did actually have the marking on the cream. It's given over the counter in Italy. I can't believe he brought it on tour with him. Anyway, but he brought it on tour, gave a couple of massages to Jannik Sinner, got into his system in a microscopic amount, and that's how he tested positive for that. With Iga Swiatek, it was a contaminated sample of melatonin, the kind of sleep aid that she took. I think it was during the Asian swing or so when she tested positive, when she was struggling with sleep.
Mm.
When you read the cases, they were consistent with what was claimed, and that's why the sentences were quite lenient and small. And they didn't hide what they, you know, were saying. Like, they basically said, this was in her system, this is why it was. The issue with Sinner was more about, was the sentence a bit too lenient because of his status? The flip side that you could say is, because he's the world number one, he has access to the best lawyers in the world, and funding isn't an issue, so he can put a much stronger defence than someone who's 200 in the world. I don't know, you can argue either way. Basically, when it came into this season, WADA were challenging what he had been given as suspension, were going to take him to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, but they reached a settlement, he had his 3-month ban. Some people think it's convenient that he came back in time for Rome, so he didn't miss any of the Grand Slams. I don't know, I suppose that's up to each person to decide. But I think on the merits of the actual cases themselves, the findings were consistent with what was alleged.
Okay, no, that's very well detailed and laid out, so thank you for that. On the court, on the action then, only 5 weeks have passed since Carlos Alcaraz stunningly saved 3 match points in a French Open final fight back for the ages, but his hopes of a third straight victory at Wimbledon were dashed by his great rival. A deserving victory for Yannick?
Yeah, I was going to bring in some sort of like condolence chocolates or something for you.
to Carlos.
I'm a Sinner man, by the way.
All right. Oh, I know, yeah.
Controversial.
No, I think it was actually great, and probably the rivalry needed it. Actually, people were comparing it a bit to when Nadal finally beat Federer at Wimbledon, and how that was really important to show that he could actually beat him on his home turf, so to speak. So Alcaraz had won the last 5 matches, obviously that extraordinary final in Roland Garros. So the pressure was kind of on Sinner to break that stranglehold on the rivalry, and Sinner was absolutely brilliant. With Alcaraz, we've always seen, as magnificent as he is when he's on, he fluctuates in form much more than Jannik Sinner. Jannik Sinner is very much in the Djokovic mold, where he's going to play about 80 to 90% of his level for most of the season, hence why he's world number one and he wins most of the titles that he enters. Alcaraz's ceiling is higher than Jannik Sinner, but he doesn't maintain it to the same degree. Now, Roland Garros, when they were neck and neck, Alcaraz was able to go into this kind of overdrive gear that Jannik Sinner couldn't compete with at those moments. But in Wimbledon, apart from at the end of the first set where he kind of produced some of his extraordinary shot making and defence, he was a little flat relative for him afterwards. Sinner played a much better tactical match in terms of trying to keep the court very narrow when he's playing, just like hitting down the middle, taking advantage off his back and in particular to strike early. That's rewarded much more on grass than clay. So obviously clay you're expecting long rallies, but Sinner served really well, got a first strike in to keep Alcaraz a bit off balance. And then when Alcaraz was kind of, we mightn't say panicking, but trying to come up with incredible tennis, he was struggling to fill in the gaps, to like spot those different areas. He made some peculiar choices with drop shots and drop volleys, which is obviously very risky with someone as fast as Jannik Sinner. But the rivalry probably needed it. And now it's very exciting going forward because we know they can beat each other on all the different surfaces and have these great contests.
Okay, so pivotal moment in this modern rivalry of men's tennis. The ladies' final. Bit anticlimactic.
The ladies' final was really tragic, actually, it's kind of an overdone maybe word, but Amanda Nisimova is like a fantastic player with a great story. And actually the first Grand Slam I really went to, kind of having done the site, was the 2019 French Open. And I saw her there at it because people were talking about, you have to see the 17-year-old. She's amazing. And her backhand is just magnificent. It's one of the best in the world. And she's a great story coming back after, obviously, the horrendous thing of her father dying really young and her kind of trying to take a break from the game to get her career back together. But she just came up against the steam train that is Iga Świątek in the final. Iga Świątek's record in finals is extraordinary. So she's 22-5 going in. So she basically just wins finals when she gets there. And she's a little like Federer in terms of, she generally starts really fast and starts to run away and you have to keep up with her. And for poor Amanda Nisimova, you had that combination of Iga starting incredibly focused, the best she's ever played on grass by miles, and Nisimova struggling with the moment of being, you're in your first major final, you're in your first Wimbledon final, playing against such an extraordinary player. And when you take that together, Iga just raced away and there was no stopping her.
Okay. But you would imagine and you would hope, or will we expect Nisimova to recover?
Yeah, what you really, really hope is that she gets back there again, because it was a little bit like...
Is it more hopeful than expectant though?
I think on the grass, she has a better chance. We're talking best of 3. There have been multiple new champions in Wimbledon, I think the last 6 or 7 years, a new champion. So it isn't the grind it is, let's say, on clay or the hard courts where everyone plays well. Wimbledon is still a bit specialised. It rewards people who are power hitters, who can strike early. Everyone generally plays well on the other surfaces. So she does have a chance. I hope she does, because I don't want that to be like her footmark in history of being, she played that final where she lost 6-love, 6-love in under an hour to Iga Świątek, because she's a much better player than that. So yeah, I really hope she's able to rebound, maybe over the American hard courts.
Brilliant stuff. Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View, thank you as always. Alan Colley, thank you. Big thanks to our producer, Andrew O'Connor. This evening's broadcast coordinator was Laura Lee Davis. And a big thanks to you for tuning in. Do stay tuned to 2FM, because after the news, we are going to be crossing live to Beto da Silva with a new music show. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. We've Mark Langdon, Paul Corrie. We'll hear from Fintan McCarthy and plenty more besides. Have a great evening.